Today's guests on Unfiltered are international superstars. They've sold over 20 million albums worldwide. Now, when I say I grew up with these two, I mean I grew up with these two. Foster and Alan, you're very welcome to Unfiltered.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, for anyone who doesn't know, Mick Foster is my granddad of Foster and Alan. So I'm going to be referring to granddad, or Mick, as granddad today. So it'll be granddad and Tony for today's podcast anyways. So lads, you're together 50 years. That's an incredible amount of time. Tell me a little bit about how you actually started.
Well, I was playing in a local group up near where Tony is from, called the Marylanders. And he used to come in when he was coming from school to listen to us rehearsing. And then in 1967, he left school and he joined us. So we're whatever, from 67 to now, we've been playing together on and off. And then 75, we decided that we'd start Foster and Alan and just have the two of us rather than have to pay six or seven lads.
Tony, you're originally from Mount Temple. That's correct. And granted, you're originally from Kildare. So how did you actually cross paths then?
Well, in 1960, which is whatever, 64 years ago or thereabouts, we moved from Kildare to Milltown, to Rathconrath. And I finished my national school days in Milltown. I learned all my music in that area. And then, as I was saying to you, I joined this little group in up near Tony in Mount Temple, well, Drum Rainey, really. And that's how we ran into one another in about 1965 or that.
When you first started, you were doing your own thing, you had your own bands, and then was it you, Grandad, that said to Tony, right, I'll try a band out with you, and if that doesn't work, let's go out on our own as Foster and Alan?
That was the kind of Tony, I gave about 7 years trying to convince him to forget about bands and come just with the two of us. And eventually...
And a slow mover. The money wasn't great nowadays.
Eventually he says, look it, you come with us with the band for 6 months and if it doesn't happen, then I'll go with you. So lucky enough, the band didn't go. So he came with me and that's nearly 50 years ago.
Oh my God. So Tony, you were hard enough to persuade then to go on.
Yeah, well, I love the band scene. It was great crack. You know, there was five or six lads on stage. You were playing different types of music, a bit of pop, a bit of country, a bit of Irish, you know. And in fairness, what Mick was at was the right idea. I kind of knew that, you know, but still wanted to prove to myself. We knew after a short time that the band wouldn't last, you know. So we were actually in England on tour when a friend of ours, Paddy Callaghan, he was opening a pub in Kilburn Tube Station. And we had a session in his pub a few nights before, and I was playing the piano and Mick was playing the accordion. So he said, would you stay back, lads, for a week? And play in the pub. We played in the pub for the whole week. We had a great week and we actually made money. So that was the deciding factor straight away.
That is incredible. And yeah. Tony, did you ever envisage the success story that Foster and Alan has actually become?
And I think we both knew after that week that we could make a living playing in the pubs. That wasn't a problem. We never saw Top of the Pops or anything like that happening, you know. We did make an album before we kind of went on the road and all that. We did it all the right way, but we didn't think that we'd end up touring the world in concert, you know.
It's really tough being a musician, but was not being successful ever an option? Or what way was your mindset at that time?
No, I could never see anything any making a living playing music.
Okay. Yeah,
from the day I was going to school, that's all I wanted to do. Yeah. I mean, I had loads of different jobs, but I used to say to lads, You'd worry all day and work about getting off in time to go play, you know.
Yeah.
You'd never worry about getting home in time to go to work.
Okay.
That wasn't a problem at all. But and I think, well, as I said, after that week in London, we both knew that it was on the cards that we were going to work at this from here on.
And Granda, did you always want to be famous or was that just something that happened?
I didn't really want to be famous. I just wanted to be an accordion player. And the famous end of it didn't come into it. But
you're now a famous accordionist.
I am, after 50 or 60 a year.
But
all we wanted to do was to be able to make enough money playing music without having to have a day job as well. And it took us 2 years, which was a very short time in this business. We started in 75. By 77, we were gone professional.
Wow.
And But I mean, we worked so hard at that. At the very start, Tony and myself went to Dublin. Because bear in mind now, we had no phones in the house and there was no mobile phones around that, but we didn't even have a house phone. So we went to Dublin and we got all the local papers up from around Ireland, around the country, the, you know, the Westmeath Examiner, the Longford Leader, whatever, the Tipperary Guardian, whatever the local papers, we got them in essence, and we came home and we studied where there was music in these pubs, kind of similar to us. And we wrote to these places. And we made, as Tony was saying, we made an LP and we put sent an LP and the letter. And I don't think anyone refuses. We always got in. And then once you get in the one night, it's a kind of up to yourself then whether you're good enough to get back. If they give you a chance, you better avail of it. And lucky enough, you know, we did. And we're still here.
Still getting back.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. So, sorry, why did you go to Dublin? Was that the that was
well, Easons in Dublin, they carried all the provincial papers.
Wow.
Didn't matter what county you're from, you could get your local paper in Easons in Dublin.
That
like
was
if we went into town, you'd get all the get the local papers here, but you wouldn't get the local papers in Cork or Kerry.
That was very clever.
Oh, I'm telling you.
You were on the ball with your marketing. Like, that was so, so clever.
We'd have done some job on internet if we had it.
Honest to God. Oh. Like, imagine if social media was around when you started. Yeah, like, yeah. That is some dedication.
Now you know where you got it from.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But you know what I find so funny is that I actually didn't realise the extent of your success growing up, which is insane. Obviously, you did, you were in the thick of it, but as a child, you just don't see your granddad as this superstar that everyone else sees him as, you know? And, like, for me, I know, looking back, like, reflecting on it, I know it felt different, but I wasn't aware of it at the time. So, for example, I'd be walking through town with granddad, and then everyone would be stopping him, asking him, yeah, for his autograph or saying hello to him, and I'd say, and who was that? And he'd say, I had no clue. I was like, all right, okay.
And I still wouldn't have a clue most of the time.
And then I do remember some of my friends, maybe in primary school, asking for your autograph, but it wasn't. I do remember then seeing you playing for the first time, and I was like, this is not aligning. Like, you're wearing this sparkly, shiny white suit. This is not what he usually wears. We're usually, like, knee-deep in muck, wearing wellies. And it's just so mad for me to look on at that. But when did ye actually realise, okay, we're actually a big deal?
I don't think we ever saw ourselves as a big deal, but we did, I'd say, after Top of the Pops, I suppose, in England. But here, I mean, it was flying for us up to, from as Mick said, 2 years after we started, we signed the record deal with CMR Records, and they had their own radio show. So we were getting played on RT Radio every day. And at that stage, we realised, you know, when you go back to a place you played maybe a year beforehand, and all of a sudden there's a cover charge and it's full, you know, then you begin to realise, well, it's not too bad, you know.
And then earlier you were talking about your day job, and you were thinking, what time am I going to be finished at so I can go play music?
Yeah.
But granted, what day jobs did you have before you play music?
Well, I suppose if you care to mention any job, I probably did most of them. but both of us served our time in a hardware shop, builders providers. And then I was lucky enough to have a friend called Jack Loram, the Lord have mercy on him. But Jack used to be in, he was a martyr for Irish music. He'd be in our house, you know, even at night going to school, and no saying if I'm going home, and my mother going bananas because I had to get up for school the next morning. But I was saying to him one time, you know, it's a kind of a persecution having to be in work, you know, at 9 o'clock and not finishing until 6, and you may be playing in Limerick or somewhere. So he said, can you paint? And I says, well, sure, I suppose I can. Well, he had a bit of a, he was a small contractor, so he had a bit of a painting job. So I went out and painted for a month. And then he said to me, can you lay blocks? I says, I never seen a lad laying blocks, let alone be able to do them. So he brought me out, showed me how to to plumb a block and level it and square a building. And then he handed me a trowel, a lump hammer and a level. He says, now you're a block layer. And I went at that, and then I went with the Gallagher brothers, who were block laying contractors. And I went with them for probably until we went professional. But it was great, because when you were doing working for yourself, as in block laying, you know, of a night we wouldn't be playing, you could work as long as you like. In the summertime you could work till dark, but then if you had to leave at 2 or 3 o'clock in the day, you could, because you weren't on a week's wages or a daily wage. You were on whatever blocks you led, you were paid for. So that was mighty handy. And Tony was carpet fitting.
Brilliant. So you made it work for yourselves at that time.
Yeah, well, you know, as little work as possible. That was the name of the game. Yeah, I suppose I served my time in the hardware business, but I was working, serving my time in Coughlin, O'Connell's and Moat. And they had a hardware shop, a grocery shop, and a pub, singing lounge. So of a Saturday night, I'd be inside in the lounge playing music with Josie Albson and Willie. So I got off, like the hardware shop didn't close till 10 o'clock of a Saturday night, but I was in there from about 9 singing, you know, so I had a break. And it, again, you know, because Noel O'Connell was into music himself, he'd let you off any time to go and play. Yeah. So it was never a major problem.
And Tony, did you, what you learned from your day job then, did you apply anything that you learned from then into your music?
Well, because both of us served our time, we learned to respect the job. If you were to be somewhere at a certain time, you had to be there. Now, I wasn't a great timekeeper, but this guy here, he taught me a lot about timekeeping. You know, I become very, very good at being on time.
Okay.
Yeah. So I give him credit for that.
Yeah, that's
but,
something.
But also, you know, we're always in time going to a gig. We were always there in time, had the gear up in time, and what's more important, we always left in time to come home as well. We didn't hang around after, you know, it was 11:30 show, that was it. It was over at 11:30.
I'm laughing because that time we shot the documentary a couple of years ago, I can't remember, the call time was like, I don't know, 2 o'clock or something. I knew Grandad was really good at time. Yeah. So we ended up being there, I think, 3 hours earlier, sitting in the car going, right, what do we do now? So we couldn't get it. Do you remember?
I do remember. It was when we were doing that thing with the young musicians.
Oh, and, yeah.
Lost in the music.
Yeah.
And we were to be such a place in Dublin at such a time. And I figured, you know, the traffic would be haywire if we left when we should leave.
Yeah.
So we left an hour or an hour and a half earlier, and we never hardly seen a car. We were up in an hour, and then we had to talk rubbish and walk around the place till everyone else came.
I just know from going to your shows, one of my favourite lines that you say, Grandad, on stage is, "Top of the Pops is long gone and we're still here."
Yeah.
And I get so proud when you say that. It's just, I don't know, it's the best feeling every time you say that. Why, Grant, why do you think Foster and Allen is so successful?
Looking back, there was nobody before us. There's nobody coming behind us doing the same type of stuff. So, you know, without having sounding as if we have swelled heads, we had no competition. Because, you know,
that
everyone
does sound
was, like you. Well, maybe I may have a bit as well. You don't. But, you know, we hadn't any competition, really. There was, you couldn't compare us to anyone else, because we weren't a folk group, we weren't a ballet group, we weren't a Kelly band group, we weren't a country group, we were doing a little bit of everything.
We were just about a group.
Yeah.
Two of us.
So, even looking back now, 50 years later, we can't say, oh, there's a couple of young fellas coming on now kind of doing the same stuff as we were doing.
Yeah.
There isn't. So I suppose there was a niche in the market and we were just lucky enough to fall into it and hang on to it, and we're still hanging on to it.
Fair play to you. You're doing an incredible job of it. But I think your entire marketing, even though I don't even know where you were that you were marketing, because marketing is such a thing now, like there's college courses on marketing, but you were doing this a long time ago. And I think at the time when you were on Top of the Pops, I think people thought you might have wore the green suits as a marketing plan. when in fact you were actually wearing them long before Top of the Pops.
Yeah, about 7 years before Top of the Pops.
Yeah, like that's great. I didn't know that until recently. That's incredible. So whose idea was it to wear the suits in the first place?
Well, it wasn't our idea, but we did an album for Release Records. That was the first album we ever did. And Jimmy McGee, or the late Jimmy McGee, who was a sports reporter and commentator for television, Jimmy was had something to do with Release Records. But we had a meeting with Jimmy and Mick O'Riordan, who worked for Release. And Jimmy says, we're doing this album, right? Jimmy said, there's a video or a film out at the moment called Barry Lyndon. He says, and the guys are dressed in medieval Irish costumes. He says, you should dress up in that for the album sleeve. So we said we would. Now, they were Martin Green, when we dressed up first. They were blue, or no, they were, yeah, blue and
brown
white.
Brown and beige.
Yeah,
and different colours.
They were made up from curtain material, actually, the first ones.
Wow.
But we only wore them for the photograph. But then we got an offer to go to America for Patrick's Day. So we decided we get them made in green and white for America.
So clever.
So that's how, and I don't know whether it wasn't. But of course, the one great thing about them is that people saw us and they said, oh, them two guys were on television the other day.
Yeah.
You know, so they remembered the suits if they didn't remember us. And then when we got to Top of the Pops, we decided we would still wear them.
Yeah.
So we wore them on Top of the Pops. And it was great because the English media really fell for it. They took to it big time.
They did. Yeah. They picked up on it. They were iconic. Like people think of you, that is one of the things that they think of. Yeah. So, Grandad, where are those suits now?
Well, I gave mine to a first cousin of mine for a fancy dress thing about 35, 40 years ago, and I've never seen it since.
Right. I haven't seen him since.
Once or twice, he's in Australia. And I think Tony has his, but Charmaine wouldn't fit on my leg now, let alone around my belly.
I have some of them still. Keith, my son, he had one on him. He just put on for the crack one day. And it fitted him, which was, I'd say when we wore them, I had about 24 waist or something like that.
Oh my God. And
maybe 30.
Give or take.
Give or take, yeah.
A 30 inch waist, no, plus fat.
Yeah. Plus fat.
Or plus fat.
Plus fat.
But
they definitely did their job big time, you know.
Yeah, they really did.
I mean, we never said we were going to be leprechauns, but everybody thought we were, so we didn't argue with them. We said, yeah, we are.
He just went with it.
I'll go with the flow.
And on Top of Tops, that day, like, bring me back to that day, because I'd love to know, like, what was going on or how you were feeling.
I never seen Top of the Pops till I was on it.
Right, okay. Well, Tony, were you nervous?
Yeah, a bit, because I had to sing. You know, they wouldn't let him use the accordion.
Okay.
So he picked up a guitar and played it.
Right.
And I had a guitar. Now, the track was recorded the day before in the BBC studios. You couldn't use your own backing track around. It had to be recorded by the BBC band, the orchestra. So that was recorded the day before, and then I sang the song live the day. Yeah, so it was great crack. But no, I loved Top of the Pops. I used to watch Top of the Pops every Thursday. Two shows I always had to see was Top of the Pops and the Monkees. They were on every week. Mick had never seen either. And the laughable thing was they wouldn't let him use his accordion, and Dexy's Midnight Runners were on afterwards. And not alone had the accordion, they had accordion, there was a carbon copy of his. But that's just, I don't know why.
And Grandad, were you annoyed that they wouldn't let you use your
not
accordion?
Not a bit.
He was mad to play the guitar.
I knew about four chords on the guitar, and Tony showed me how to put them. And as I say, I had no idea about Top of the Pops, and when these record company boys said that they didn't say don't use the accordion, they said would you mind not using it, it might look better if you have two guitars. So that's how that came about. And
very obliging of you.
I couldn't care less. It didn't make a bad difference.
We arrived, we were there, and Liam Hurley, who had produced the song, he had his guitar with him, so I rang Seamus Moore, the singer in London, and he arrived up with another guitar, so we had two guitars for the Top of the Pops.
Brilliant. And Tony, I know you're big into TV, so you would have watched Top of the Pops, whereas Grandad didn't. I think you've a few funny stories, in the sense of, I remember Grandad coming home from a tour one time telling me he met a few young lads Pop stars, I think they were, is what he said.
Yeah, we were in an airport in England.
Yeah, tell me about that.
And,
who were the young lads?
We were chatting these fellas, and when they walked away, Mick says, "Who's them boys?" I said, "That's Westlife." He never even didn't know them.
Oh my God, do you know?
Now they were very young at the time, in fairness.
They were still unbelievable. Like him coming home telling me this, I was like heartbroken. I'm like, did you get me their autograph? And he was like, no, didn't know who they were. They were young lads, that's all I knew.
That's all I knew. They were over on tour and they were real young. We were getting stuff off the carousel luggage and they were doing the same.
That is so funny. I
had no idea who they were.
And then another time I remember you calling me from Australia when you were on tour and you were like, oh, I was in the gym and this young one had pink hair. And I was like, as in, was it the singer Pink? I said, yeah, that's her. I was like, oh my God, I would have given my left arm to meet her. And he's just like, you're just meeting all these famous people and it's just going over your head.
I'm totally over my head. Unless they play an accordion, I don't know them.
You have no interest.
No one whatsoever.
What's the saying that you always say? I hate...
Pop music, the devil hates holy water.
That made the headlines, I think.
And then more for a while there around the flat.
It did, didn't it? So going back to the green suits again. So after after Top of the Pops, he then added more band members, and then he changed up your image.
Well, we had to, Ollie Candy and Desi Haynes joined the band, so we had to either dress them in green suits, or so we decided we dropped the green suits and we got a ornery, decent, respectable suits to wear. So we've been dressed like that ever since. We have moved from colour to white. We now have white suits that we wear on stage.
Yeah, they stand out really well on stage.
Yeah, they're different, yeah. Very good.
Yeah, and again, they're iconic as well to Foster and Allen, which is also... Like, it's so... I don't know, I think your image is so important, but I feel like ye were so ahead of your times with everything that you were doing, like going up to Dublin, getting all of the newspapers, wearing the leprechaun outfits, even though you weren't leprechauns, and then wearing the white suits.
We were leprechauns in size only.
Yeah, maybe.
It was a good job we started with the green and went to white. We didn't start with the white and try and get green ones on us. And now...
maybe that one went down as well.
No, no.
But you've sold millions of records worldwide, but granted, you've never actually wrote your own songs.
It's like tunes. There's too many good songs out there. Too many good tunes, and then, but we have other people writing for us, like, you know, and they've written, I mean, after all these years, Barry Coleman and Ollie Kennedy from Mullingar, they wrote that. Charlie Lansbury wrote I Will Love You All My Life. PJ Murray from Clare is writing a load of stuff for us. He wrote We Owe It All to You, and There's Life in the Old Dog Yet, and Mrs. Brown's Voice. So we have loads of lads that are able to do it. We just, they give it to us and we record it and do the best we can with it, but about writing, no, I wouldn't have a clue where to start.
Well, that's fair enough. And Tony, I just know from being around a lot of musicians lately that they're all so keen to write their own songs. But I suppose it's like any kind of business that we should just let go of the things that we're not good at and let other people step in.
So, like, we have fantastic songwriters, but, you know, and as Mick said, there's too many good songs out there, old ones and new ones. So why would you be bothered writing them, you know?
Yeah, don't try and reinvent the wheel, as they
say. Exactly,
correct.
Yeah.
So what is the best thing about being a part of Foster and Allen? Tony, I'm going to go to you for that one.
It's the fact that we've done something that we've always wanted to do, played music, enjoyed it, you know, and I suppose when we're long gone, somebody will remember Foster and Allen for their music, you know.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Grandad, what about you then? What's the best part, or the best thing about being Foster and Allen?
Well, I suppose we've been all over the world several times, and someone else paying for it. And travelling business class, and staying in the best hotels, and, you know, there'd be people, you know, that'd give anything to, you know, say to get to Australia. We were in Australia 20 times. And there'd be no downside except, I suppose, when you get to a certain age, the travelling. I mean, I'd play more music at a flycule or a traditional session than I would at a concert with Tony. But it's to get them from A to B is the killer. And even if you're going to Australia or New Zealand and you're travelling business class, you're still above in the sky the same time as anyone else, like, you know. So
yeah,
it doesn't, you have more room and you might have better food and all this, but you're still above in the clouds, or above the clouds for, well, you know, from Dubai to Auckland was the last way we went from Dublin, Dubai, Dubai, Auckland, and it's 16 hours from Dubai to Auckland. And that 68 hours above, like a jackdaw, is a killer.
I'm laughing because you mentioned there about, you know, getting older, going travelling, and I'm there going, I wasn't too old when I went to Australia with you and I nearly died. Oh my good God. Let's go back to that for a while. So I just remember saying, I have to go and experience Australia with Foster and Alan. Like, I, you know, just, I have to do it in my life. I really do. And I remember just going, I'd be well able to keep up with these lads, no bother. I was like, traveling business class, or this is the life. But you still are so tired when you get to the other side. Yeah. And I remember we flew into Brisbane and I was exhausted and you were just like buzzing around the place. I was like, I need to go to bed. And like, do you think you just get used to it, or what way is it?
Yeah, you get used to it. When we'd arrive wherever, you know, as it is now, say, Myra and Brian, they can go to bed because we mightn't be playing for 3 days after arriving. But the minute we arrived, Tony and myself were doing radio and television and newspapers and magazine interviews, and so you haven't time to bless yourself. And then of course, I don't know whether it affects Tony or not, but jet lag I used to be under fierce pressure with jet lag. You'd be absolutely walking into walls with sleep, and the minute you go to bed, the minute you go to bed, your eyes are bing, you were mad awake.
Yeah.
And then when you had to get up the next morning, you know, you wanted to stay in bed, and but you had no choice, only do what I mean. I often lay on the floor in the dressing room, getting a little bit of sleep, maybe 10 minutes before you go on the stage.
I don't know, I just was so, I remember you sneering me because I was sleeping on the tour bus and you were like, this one's not it for it. You were taking pictures of me sleeping. I just have a whole, like, different respect for you and musicians in general after that, because I just seen the firsthand the hard work that you put into your tour. It was absolutely incredible. Like, it was non-stop for you. Like, it was all right for me. I was there having the crack and just slotting into your days, but like, it was just go, go, go for you. Really was,
well,
wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the way we like to tour. You know, we like to work every night and travel every day if you have to, but the last thing we like on tour is 3 or 4 days off. We just, we can't act that at all, like, you know. But yeah, I suppose yeah, you're ready for it when you get there, you know, and you turn on and you do the job and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a day when you come home.
I'm thinking about funny things that happened on that tour anyway. I have to talk about, remember you went off and got a haircut.
I did. It was a kind of fierce warm, and I decided I'd get a number one haircut, and went into the barber next door, and he'd get me a number three, and he says, I think that's enough. I said, no, keep going. So he gave me a number one, and there'd be more hair on an egg when I came out. And then when I arrived back into the room, and Myra saw this number one haircut, she nearly went bananas.
I thought you were going to say she was going to go and get one of them.
Into George the barber.
Yeah.
She's like, where are you after getting your hair cut? You're like, George around the corner. And why did he do this?
Yeah. She had a sense of humour failure when she seen me at number one.
Oh, yeah, that's so funny. What are some of the funniest things that happened when you were on tour over the years? Like that, anyway.
Well, that's definitely one of them, I think, yeah.
There's a lot of them we can't tell you.
We can't repeat.
What happens on tour stays on tour.
Correct.
We're lucky we have bad memories. We don't.
But that particular tour, what happened on tour, went on Facebook and Instagram for me. I had everything up on.
You can be sure of that.
Where was your favourite place or your favourite venue to ever play, Tony?
I think I've always enjoyed the gigs in Belfast and Dublin and Glasgow, always great, you know. But having said that, we just finished the tour of Ireland and there wasn't one concert in that I didn't enjoy. They were all absolutely brilliant. They were all mostly hotels, you know.
Yeah.
So when you do the hotel, especially nowadays, because our audience are that bit older, And they like to come in, sit down, have a drink or a cup of tea or something, and take it easy, you know. But they're all up around you on the stage, and it's great.
And Grandad, what about you? Where's your favourite place or venue to play?
Probably my favourite country would have been South Africa. It was so different.
Yeah.
It was class. And the last tour of South Africa we did was in 2015. And in the venue outside Johannesburg, we had 2,500 people.
And do you know what I noticed when I was on tour with you in Australia? Was, like, I've seen you in Ireland, and then going to see you in Australia at the concerts, the crowd reacted the same to the song, don't they? They react the same to
everywhere.
The same song. Yeah.
Well, it's Nick always says that if you didn't hear them talking, you wouldn't know where they were.
Yeah.
Because they all react the very same everywhere. They just sound different when they talk to you, you know.
I know. It's mad. So do you find that weird when you're wherever you are touring in the world?
Well, it's great. It's great that they actually come in and enjoy the music, you know. And our audience is brilliant because they actually come for the music, you know. I mean, we could go out after a show, there could be 1,000 people in the hall, and be lucky if there was 50 people waiting. They just come in, listen to the music, and buy CDs and go home.
Yeah.
You can't get better than that.
You really can't.
No, no, no.
And, you know, people see the performance that you put on, but so much work has to go into that before you even go on tour. So, Grandad, do you enjoy the promotion of the tour? Like, a lot of hard work has to go into promoting a tour.
I wouldn't be as mad about promotion now as Tony, maybe, or whatever. But whatever we have to do, we do. I mean, years ago, you know, you'd have to go and maybe do 10 days or a fortnight, you know, say in England, promoting the tour.
Yeah.
All we do now is phone interviews, so you can do it from home, and mobile phones, they can ring you anywhere at the lake. And I think at this stage, you still have to promote, regardless of who you are. I mean, Arthur Guinness is still promoting, and lads that knock you down to get pints of porter, like, but if the likes of him has to advertise, it's very easy to understand why lads like us have to advertise.
Oh, for sure.
I think it's not that people don't know who you are, but they don't know you're here.
You know,
if you're coming to play in Cork tonight, well, you have to let the people of Cork know you're coming down there, you know. So the radio ads and interviews, and that's important for just to sell the show, you know.
For sure. Because at one point, Tony, were you doing a radio interview a week in the UK at one point?
Oh, we used to do 10 days. Around all the radio stations, yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, at a time. We'd go over maybe in September and do 10 days interviews. Or maybe we could drive for 10 days non-stop going around the country. And then when we come back for the tour in November, you know, people would know exactly what was happening. That, you know. Well, you'd be promoting new CD and the tour at the same time, you know.
I just remember, Grandad, from when we were growing up, you always had your diary out in front of you, right beside the phone. You had your schedule. If anyone called, you knew exactly where you were, what you were doing. And that's something that I have learned from you, is to have your schedule at the ready at all times, which I do. And it's so beneficial. But what is your go-to excuse for something if you don't want to do it?
If I don't want to
we're very good liars.
If I don't want to do something in Ireland, I say, well, I have an interview in England that day. Or if someone wanted me to do something, you know, next June, I could say, well, I have to go to a funeral that day, you know, I can't go.
But in fairness, there's very few things that we don't want to do, you know.
Yeah.
And there's very few things that we have to turn down, you know. But I mean, sometimes you just can't do everything, you know.
You can't oblige everyone basically.
The man that taught me all my Kaylee and traditional music was Frank Gavigan. And Frank was a first cousin of Joe Dolan. And several things he taught me. But one of the things he did that he taught me that Myra goes bananas about. He'd say to you, you know, if some lad came looking for you to do something.
Yeah.
He might say, yeah, you'll do that, no problem. And when your man had be gone, I'd say, you have no intention of doing that. And he used to say to me, you know what I'm going to tell you now, Mick Foster? Never send anyone away with an aching heart.
That is brilliant.
I'm telling you.
I love it. And the other one that you taught me was, and I was teaching them all this up in RTE only recently, when you don't know somebody's name,
yeah,
and you say, and you're there, like I do kind of just keep talking to see, can I figure it out, like who they are? And then if I don't, I'll go, you taught me this. You'll say, what's your name? And they'll say, Mick. And I say, I know it's Mick, but what's your second name? So you get two names and you're like, oh, thank God. The funny thing is, as well, when you tell people your name, you know, the minute I say Foster, they're like, you must play music. And when the reality is, I grew up in RTE basically with you. I've been to RTE so many times with you over the years. But I was obsessed with the lighting, the cameras, everything. And that's how I ended up getting into this industry now. And I just think it's one of the best industries, but it's not like you're 9 to 5. It's very different. So I was so lucky, Granda, to have you there to help me when I started my business, to go to you or torment you, ringing you every 5 minutes, been like, give me some advice on this. What do you think I should do here?
No, it's one of these businesses that, you know, it's a great, but, you know, the downside, if you want the downside, if we don't work, we don't get paid.
You don't need.
There's no... Correct. Well, I have plenty of work, as you can see.
You must have been busy.
But there's no sick paying, or there's no holiday paying, or there's no... You know, a lot of say, oh, next month is a bank holiday. Wouldn't make a bit of difference to me what it was, because I wouldn't know a bank holiday from... Because it makes no difference. Either we're working or we're not.
Bank holidays just don't exist. Or weekends in general don't exist when you work for yourself.
No.
They really don't. But you never pushed music onto us, which in a way I kind of like, that we were just left to do our own thing and find our own feet. And I think people had this perception that when we were sitting at home just having dinner, that we were all like playing music and stuff like that. And that just wasn't the reality.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
But I mean, everyone of the family got the chance if they wanted.
Exactly.
And only Denise, my oldest daughter, she's the only one that kept hold. She teaches piano.
Yeah.
But your dad, Jackie, and the twins, Sandra and Louise, they all went, you know, different jobs. I mean, they couldn't do what they do. So
yeah,
there's no point in saying I wish they came and followed in my footsteps. They can't do what they do. So there you go.
But I just think let people be their own person and live their own life and follow their own path instead of...
Make their own mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. And Tony, was it like that then for you and your kids?
Well, my two lads both play music and both fairly good at it, but they don't do it for a living.
Yeah.
Well, neither of them would.
Yeah.
I mean, Ian, they had a couple, they had one particular kind of a rock band and they rehearsed every night for, say, about 5 years. And Ian loved going out to rehearse, but he wouldn't go play live if you paid him a fortune.
Yeah, isn't Keith, it interesting?
Keith works in events now. He does all that kind of work, you know. And loves that. And like our job, he's working day and night, and he has, you know, there's no particular time on or off, but he loves doing that.
Yeah.
And Ian is a graphic designer. He works for a pharmaceutical company.
Yeah.
But again, both love music, but no interest in playing live. Yeah. But of course, it's completely different now too. Like in the old days, you could go in and play in a pub or something like that, but you can't do that anymore, you know.
No, it's completely changed. Yeah. And then I know I keep talking about the marketing that you have done. It's changed so much for musicians in the sense of the musicians have social media now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, could you imagine if he did have social media? What way do you think it would have been?
Oh, I think we'd have done exactly what we did.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been a problem. I think it was our music and our ability to work that got us where we were. Not, you know, okay, the social media, if it was there then, would have taken place too, you know. But, I mean, we signed a record deal with CMR Records in, what, 78 or
78.
78. And we still have the same record deal with them. You know, we never left them. Yeah. So, like, it's a matter of deciding what you want and sticking with it, you know.
And then the thing that was great when we started, if we got a play on radio, everyone in Ireland heard us. There was only the one radio station. If we did television, everyone in Ireland seen us. There was only the one TV channel.
Yeah.
And they started doing radio and television in 1963 when I was 15. And Tony and myself started we did our first television thing in 77.
Because you have a good story, actually, that you mentioned you starting the radio when you were 15. You couldn't make it up to RTE one time.
Oh, I missed the bus.
Missed the bus.
And I had to tone my way.
Yeah.
And I was going from Eden Derry.
Right.
I had friends, the Rhines over there, they were all great musicians. And I used to spend every weekend there. And so as far as my mother and father were concerned, I was getting the bus from Eden Derry to Dublin, which was not a big deal. And that's what I was supposed to do. But I missed the bus. And had to tome, and my mother didn't know that I missed the bus until she heard me talking on the wireless. And Radio Erin was upstairs in the GPO at that time.
That's right. So you said it on air that you got the
guy.
Oh, Jesus.
and the fella that used to present that program was a fella called Pat Lade. He was, as far as I know, he was one of the actors over the Abbey Theatre, but he was from Mullingar.
Oh, right.
Can he give you a lift home?
No, because he was living in Dublin. And Liam Devalley was from Mullingar.
That would have been handy.
And we gave him a lift. Kelly House was on, and Kieran Kelly's band was the band, and I was the soloist.
Yeah.
And Liam Devalley, who was a great singer from Mullingar, kind of a high-class singer, and he was a wound up a judge afterly, but a friend of ours, he used to drum with Tony myself years ago, called Johnny Moore, and Lord of Mercy and him too, but Johnny had a mini, and I had a full-size piano accordion at the time, and when Kelly House was over, it was spilling rain, and Liam Devalley was under pressure to get home, so we said, should we give you a lift home? So he was in the back, and this accordion, no room to move, and he was in the front, and Johnny driving. So, you know, there was no decent cars at that stage, no, but
we
travelled in a mini.
No bother. Once he's got there, that was the most
important
thing.
Once he got home, he was happy.
And who was your favourite person ever to interview you over the years?
God, I don't know. I mean, Gay Byrne was brilliant, you know. Gloria Hunniford is probably as good as him, and Terry Wogan, you know.
Yeah.
But they were all pretty good in those days, you know. Very, very seldom. In fact, I don't think we ever met a bad interviewer, in fairness.
Yeah.
But Gloria was great, yeah, and Terry.
I actually recently met Gloria Hunniford over on the Loose Women show. And she had great things to say about the two of you.
Oh, good for her.
So she would have interviewed you a few times then.
And her daughter, who passed away, Karen Keane, she interviewed us as well on her television show.
Wow.
She passed away very young.
And Terry Wogan went over then to the UK, so he was huge at supporting Foster
and Allen,
wasn't he?
He was Mr. Radio in the UK, yeah. He was the biggest thing ever on radio and BBC in England.
So do you think, with Ryan Tubridy now going over to the UK, that will benefit Irish artists?
Well, it won't do them any harm anyway.
Yeah.
If he is quarter as good to the Irish artists as Terry Wogan and Gloria Hunniford was, it'll be a major help.
Yeah.
And what about the recording process then for your albums? How does that work, Grandad? Take us through that process.
Well, in the early days, I made my first record in 1972 with a piano player, and it was all Kelly music. But at that time, say if the selection of tunes was 3 minutes, well, if at 2:59 you hit a wrong note, you had to go back and do the whole thing again and hope that you wouldn't hear a wrong note the next time.
Oh, that's why you asked me today, if we mess up today, do we have to record the whole thing again?
But now, if I go in and at 2:59 I hear a wrong note, they just turn back the tape a little bit and I play it and play the right note, and they take out the wrong one and play in the good one. And
so, like, a lot has changed then since he first started, because technology moves so fast these days.
Unbelievable.
It's
crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah. Well, it's easier and it's not, you know. I mean, it takes the sort of feel out of the music, I think.
The fact that
you can drop in words here and there, you know.
Okay.
But we're very lucky because we have a studio in Moat, the Roseland Recording Studio.
Yeah.
Which Seamus Cullinan runs. And, you know, if we get in with Seamus there to do a session, well, we're never under pressure, you know. So.
Yeah.
We can take our time, and if we don't feel like doing something today, we can do it some other day, you know.
Yeah.
But And technology is brilliant now. I mean, you know, as Mick says, you can put a tuner on things, which sometimes helps, sometimes it doesn't, you know. But it doesn't help to the extent that if you think you can repair it, you won't bother too hard getting it right, you know. But
we try, ain't that problem.
we try and get that. But then, like, you know, with like a Myra here, we can work miracles a lot of the time, you know. As Myra, yeah, sit down and play everything we need. And that's a huge help, you know, that you're not waiting somebody who's going to come in and be gone in an hour because there's something else on, you know.
No, it's such
it's
a work of art.
The fact that we don't have to rush. Oh, well, it's easy, but it's great. And I love the studio. I love working in the studio, yeah.
Yeah. And granted, how do you find the studio? Because we talked about touring and then we talked about the promotion of your actual music. But what about the actual creation
the
of it?
The studio is no problem because, as Tony was saying, Myra, who was my other half, she arranges and produces all my end of it, and she plays piano on it and whatever, and she tells me what to do at home, and she tells me what to do in the studio, and she tells me what to do on the tour, and so I ain't going around like a little robot, you know.
I think we need to give Myra more credit for us being around for 50 years.
Let's talk about your music videos. Your music videos are iconic. You know a Foster and Allen music video a mile off the minute you see it. Yeah. Were they fun to make? Go to you, Grandad.
They were great food. Great crack altogether. We did the first one in about 1983. And all during the 90s we did a video every year of 15 tracks. So I think we have well way over 300 videos done. And, you know, the only downside was traveling all over the place. You know, we did videos in Australia and every part, and in the UK, and we did them, you know, from Belfast to Killarney. And, but the crack was great, and we did them with an English company first. And, then with the late Ian McGarry, who was a producer in RTE, and Mick Bracken from Over the Road here.
One more.
And he's, I think 1996 or 1995, he started with us and came to Australia with us and all that carry on, and he's doing them ever since.
Yeah, I just mentioned there about Mick saying one more. So for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, tell the audience what we're talking
well,
about.
You'd be strangled doing these videos, and you know, he'd want you to sit up this way, and he'd want you to smile, and he'd want you to look out the window and whatever. And you'd do all that, and everything would be perfect. One more now, he'd say. This would be for luck in case that I'm to go wrong. One more.
He has a great phrase as well. He'd say, no, you look over there and be thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. And
look like and, you're thinking.
And he'd be behind the camera, and he'd be shouting, happy, 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 happy. And you may be doing a serious song, like, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen him in action. He's absolutely brilliant.
Oh, he's great, Craig.
So the fashion changes, technology changes, yeah. But your music your music stayed timeless,
well,
didn't it?
It did change, I suppose, when you think of, like, we recorded stuff with people like Shane Ward and Nathan Carter and things like that, you know. So it has changed a bit, but but then we always did something like that, you know. I mean, way back we did Beatles songs, we did Dire Straits songs, you know. So we've done a lot of different stuff, but everything will be done our way, that's for sure, because there is no other way that we can do it.
Yeah,
we can only do it the one way.
These are very particular, I know that.
Well, it's not that we're very particular. We wouldn't be able to do a Beatles songs the way they did it, you know.
Yeah.
So we just I claim that no matter what song you get, you can strip it back to singing with a guitar and an accordion and a vocal, and that's what we kind of do. Then you can add to it, you know.
Any show I've ever been to, any Foster and Allen show I've ever been to, he always performed to such a high standard. Like, he never let the energy drop. How do you find that, Tony?
Well, I think we know ourselves that that's what you have to do, you know.
Yeah.
And we have, God knows, we've recorded enough stuff to pick your program that you can do that with that, you know. We always start fairly lively, and like Myra has a great set she does in the middle of our show, first half, and that brings it into a different type of level, and then you can go back and slow it down a bit and then finish up on a high at the first end of the first half. And the same thing in the second half, you know. So we're lucky that we don't have to go outside our own albums to pick a program.
Yeah.
That's a huge help, you know.
And it's interesting, when I think back of being a child, like all of my childhood memories, I always remember you being around, although you were so busy and were always on tour. Mm-hmm. But you always had the summer off. So was that your choice?
That was because we did a video, as Mick says, we recorded a 15 or a 16 track video every summer.
Yeah.
And we deliberately took the summer off to do that, you know. But it was like, it was part of the year's work, you know.
Okay.
We toured March, April, October, November, you know, that and around Christmas. But then we would do an album every year as well. So we'd probably record the album early summer, and then midsummer we'd go and let the record company pick the tracks they wanted for the video, and
yeah,
we'd go out and do that. So it was great because you could work and go home at night, you know.
Yeah,
brilliant. That was the good thing about the studio and the videos. You know, when we were at home during the summer, you were basically at home every night.
Yeah. So it worked well then for like work-life balance for you then?
Everything was great. And you know, you can't get people into a concert at 7:30 of a summer's night.
Yeah.
Because our audience, you know, they could be at Hay, they could be in the Bog, they could be on holidays.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons. And
so you knew your audience off to a tee.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking there when Tony was talking, I was doing a video one time. I was thinking like Mick Bracken said.
Were you looking over there and thinking?
But I was doing a waltz, an instrumental waltz.
Okay.
And I was being at with midges.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was, between takes, I was saying, using bad language and everything, when you smarten yourselves up and words of that effect or semi-effect. Because, and it'll be granted, one more or less. But they didn't realise until I told them I was being at with midges.
Yeah.
Because they were... I had hair that time, like, you know, and they were everywhere.
Right.
But we got it done anyway.
But the consistency of the high standard is so important, because if somebody comes to your show and you're not given that level.
Oh, if you drop, you know, it's we used to say years ago,
yeah,
if we could get to a certain level,
yeah,
and go along. But there's no level playing field. You're either going up or down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, there's no... You can't just get to a certain level and keep there.
Okay.
You're either going that way or that way. And we try and keep going that way as long as we can.
So it's only since I actually started working in this industry and watching presenters, watching yourselves, again, back to the high level of performance every single time, that I've so much more respect for you, because so much can be going on. You can be tired, you can... be contrary, having a bad day, having an off day, but your audience don't care.
No.
And you have to keep
nobody cares.
Nobody cares. And you have to bring the smile, you have to bring the energy every single time. And it's only since I started working in this industry that I'm like, Jesus, it can be so exhausting.
But I think you have to have a more than a liking for this to do that.
I agree.
You know, you don't just show up and decide I have to be in good humour. I think you have to like what you're going to do, and that gives you a certain amount of, well, it gives you a lot of good humour, you know.
It's the passion, I think, that gets you through. Because you often hear now, say, with athletes today, they're looking at each other going, where are you getting the motivation?
Yeah.
You don't have motivation every single day. You really don't, but it's the discipline of just showing up and being there, and that's exactly what ye do, which is absolutely incredible for you to do that and to be still doing that, which is insane. If I can have half this success, or even a smidgen of the success that you have, I'll be doing very well.
And you see, if a fella or a couple, if they give 35 quid or in the way of a couple, 70 quid come into a show, they don't want to be looking up at lads with jaws on them like a Spanish ass and sour faces. You know, they want to, they're there to enjoy themselves. Yeah. So you better
and you're perform. There to help.
Yeah.
But that's what I suppose separates, you know, somebody from being really professional and why you can keep going and doing what you're doing, doesn't it?
Oh yeah.
Well, they say the difference between a professional singer and an amateur singer is that a professional singer will sing whether he wants to or not.
Yeah.
And an amateur will sing whether he can or not.
You knocked Diana Ross and Take That off the number one spot of the UK charts with By Request.
Yeah, the video, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was a video, yeah.
Yeah, because you've had that at home in the house,
yeah,
framed.
November 1993. Yeah.
And that would have been probably a lot to do with that would have been the fact that we had done a huge publicity campaign in September, October.
Yeah.
To help, you know. In those days, the record company Demon, or whoever it was, they would have they'd have a lot of shelf space for product, and they would have been doing TV advertising,
okay,
and all that, you know. So, and we would have been doing promotion as well. So it all helped and all, you know. But that would have been, I'd say we were on tour of this November.
And we had a whole section of ourselves in Woolworths, in all the Woolworths stores all over the UK. And that was major, like, you know.
Oh my God, because Woolworths was absolutely huge.
Yeah, it was massive, huge. Yeah. And you know, that time, you know, people buying presents for their mammy or their granny or their auntie Mary, when they'd go into Woolworths, we'd be there. And so they had something solid.
Yeah.
To give them, you know, and lucky enough, it was us that were given.
So now I see what you were doing. So you were, like, recording your music videos and songs in the summer,
yeah,
bringing
them
out at peak gifting time at
Christmas. Christmas market.
And then going on tour. That's so clever.
And we're still
I
doing
think
it.
That's, it wasn't, I wouldn't say it wasn't that we were very clever, but that's the way it was done. You know, that's the way the tours worked, you know.
Yeah, and it worked brilliantly.
And that's why we started tour every year on the 27th of December.
Wow.
And right up to the end of January. Because lads are buying tickets for Foster and Allen for their parents and grandparents and whatever, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Long may it last.
Yeah. Okay, so Sophie Alex Baxter, her song Murder on the Dance Floor, it was a huge hit back in the day for me and my friends anyways.
Okay.
And a new movie came out called Saltburn with Irish actor Barry Keoghan. He's from Dublin.
Yeah.
And he'd done this famous scene, famous naked dance scene. Yes, with her song Murder on the Dance Floor. And all the younger ones now on TikTok and Instagram are absolutely obsessed with this song. And the song went back to number one again. So it brought Sophie Ellis Bextor back to life, basically.
Yeah.
And he'd done something similar. Didn't dance naked, but...
No.
Well, if the price was right.
If the price was right, you'd do it.
He didn't dance at all.
It was a line that he said again in your show. He said something about, you released the song and then they forgot that they'd bought it. So you re-released it. Tell us about that.
Well, that was the truth. Like, we brought out a bunch of time in 1979 and we brought it out again in 81. And it went to number one both times. So, I mean, that was a kind of a prime example of people forgetting, you know, should we already have that at home?
Now, what happened actually was, it was number one here in 1979.
Yeah.
And then Donny Cassidy took it to UK, to Ritz Records, in 1981 to release it in the UK.
Wow.
And it came out on Ritz Records in the UK and went to number 18 in the pop charts in England. So then it went back to number one in Ireland, you know, because it was
brilliant.
In the British charts, it went back into number one.
So would you ever consider bringing it out again?
Well, you'd never know.
Third time, could you imagine? You also played in Croke Park.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, Tony, because you are a big GAA man,
I
so was that
GAA.
Pretty cool for you?
Oh, it was brilliant, absolutely, yeah, class. Getting into Croke Park and singing in the middle of the field. It was the Meath Cork All-Ireland, 87, wasn't it? Really?
Yeah.
1988. And Donny again came up with the idea of getting us to sing in the middle of the pitch. And of course, it went out live on television as well, which was great. 80,000 people.
And what was the experience like for you, Grandad?
Grant, it was, you know, you were out there. Tony sang for Cork and I sang for Meath with the RTN Boys band. And the match was a draw, so we couldn't say that one of us was better than the other. And then, for the replay, we were in on tour in England, so we couldn't do the replay.
And what about, there's a lot of work talk here, but what about for your downtime? Tony, what do you do then in your spare time?
I go to GAA matches when I can, and I watch television. Apart from that, I don't do an awful lot, you know.
Who do you support then in GAA?
Oh, Westmeath.
Westmeath.
Well, Colliery first.
I was going to say, what about Colliery?
Oh, it has to be Colliery first. We had four men on the panel last Sunday, so not too bad for a small club.
So you're there at the front row.
Our first man is Kevin Maguire. He's our captain, the Westmead captain at the moment. So.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And you mentioned to me the other day that did Trina get you a ticket for like every
match? Oh yeah, she bought me the you have to have a ticket now to get into any match, but you can buy a season ticket for the Division 3 or Division 4, Division 1, whatever you want. So she bought me a ticket for all the Division 3 matches that Westmead are in.
And what about TV then? What's your favourite TV show at the moment?
I watch anything that's on, you know. I wouldn't go home to watch something, you know. Whatever's on, I'll watch it.
You're watching love Tommy last, Tiernan, though.
Oh, yeah, love Tommy. I tape Tommy and watch him. Last of the Summer Wine, you know.
Yeah.
Open All Hours, any of that stuff. And thank God they're all being shown again, yeah.
And then, Grandad, what about you then? What do you do then in your spare time?
I play handball twice a week.
Yeah.
And I play pick and ball twice a week.
Yeah.
And I go to our local pub, which I'm... See, I'm lucky enough, I live 10, 15 minutes from where I grew up. So the lads I go for a drink with are the lads I went to the national school with.
Yeah.
And I go to hurling matches and races and stuff like that. And one of the lads that I went to school with, Noel Hedgewin, Noel, he gets the tickets for the hurling and he collects me at the house and he brings me to the match. And he brings me to Jimmy Wallace's pub after for a couple of pints, and he brings me home again.
Not so bad.
You know, talking about having a chauffeur sure is great.
That's ideal. I remember you were telling that story that you go into your local pub on a Friday. This was in an interview. You said, I go into my local pub on a Friday, and Tony turned around and said, and he comes out of a Monday.
It was on Tommy's show, actually.
I remember you mentioning to me before that you don't really drink, you don't drink on tour when you're playing, and no. I remember
definitely not when we're playing.
No,
we might drink afterwards. Well, no, we wouldn't be heavy drinkers. We'd have one or two maybe afterwards.
That kindness was a major help to us.
Yeah,
from day one that neither of us drank as such, you know.
Yeah, because I remember you saying that, you know, lads in this industry, they'd get nervous and they'd say, I'll just have one before I go on the show. Then the next show, they need two to get them to that point of feeling relaxed. And then three, and then that's why a lot of them kind of fall off the bandwagon then, because they're just struggling then with alcohol.
We never drank as such. The only thing that we used to do around this time of the year long ago, when there was only the two of us, and, you know, putting up the gear yourself and changing your clothes and playing and changing your clothes and taking it down the ground. We used to buy a box of the
Caffrey's
marshmallow Easter eggs, a full box, and we put them between us on the seats going along and we guzzle these. And that was the start of this, like, you know.
What about it? So you got into horses, but very interestingly, you got into horses because you were away on a trip. Horse riding was part of one of the activities and you were a bit nervous to go on the horse, is that right?
I wasn't a bit nervous, I was terrified.
Okay, right, okay.
And I says, the next time we're doing something like this, I know how to ride a horse.
Right.
And I went out to a lady called Anthea Rainsbury, and I says, look, I need you to teach me how to ride a horse, but I'm terrified. So she had the patience of Job.
Wow.
You know, and when they started jumping, she'd run along holding the horse's head.
Yeah.
And she'd jump along with them. The jumps wouldn't be, you know, a foot high.
Yeah.
But after a while then I got bowled as a pet pig, and it didn't matter how big the jump was. If I had a good enough horse, I'd tip over it. And then, sure, I got your brother, my grandson Daniel, into ponies, and he wound up an amateur jockey for years.
Yeah, sure. A lot of our memories are in your house, riding out, going to the point of points with Dan. The horses are so enjoyable. It was so cool to have them growing up.
And we had, there was one stage, Dan was about 8 or 9, and we had this lovely a saint of a pony, and Dan was after riding her up and down from the house to the yard, you know, up the driveway. And he was after popping her over little crossbows and all like this. And then, of course, her ladyship decided she wanted a spin, and I was leading her, you see, and we tipped along, and normally this pony would, if there's a crossbow, he'd step across it. But the fact that Dan was after riding her and jumping, when you got to the crossbow, she jumped.
Mm.
And of course, your one started to fall, and I tried to grab her, but she went the other side, and I couldn't, and she fell on the ground. And Lord, you'd hear the Dublin roar, and I terrified her, her neck was broke.
And there's video footage of this.
Oh, right. Well.
You can put it in your show.
You can put that,
I know, I need to. But funny enough, I remember you were always like, I didn't want to get back on the horse, and you were like, you're getting back on. And it's the best thing to do, yeah, is just to get to get back up when you're, after getting knocked out, like literally.
Yeah, and she was a kind of a, you know, you'd never hear any bad language or anything like that over. And she may have been 12 or 13, but we were going around, we had a course around the land. And her and I were going around together on two horses. And we jumped this particular jump together, and whatever went wrong with her, she started to fall. And the language, I'm telling you, I never heard bad language like it in my life.
I learned from the best, don't
you? Oh, you did, yeah.
I remember that. So you seem to just meet things head on then. Like, you were like terrified to go on the horses, then you learned how to ride horses, and then they became a huge part of your life.
Yeah.
And then you were
afraid to fly,
yeah.
Yeah, you were afraid to fly, yeah. And then you got...
I learned how to fly a small plane, and that don't know where put the feet.
God, I suppose you'd no choice when you're travelling to the other side of the world.
Yeah. I used to go to England with Tony, and my face would be the colour of that, and I'd my knuckles would be gone white. I wanted to say it, and then I'd look out, and I think this plane was stopped, you know, because it'd be going very slow, you'd think.
Yeah.
And we were playing one night in Pocahon. Mm-hmm. Outside Nina.
Yeah.
And there was a fella called Joe Collins. He was the chief flying instructor in Burr. And I was telling him.
Yeah.
And he said, there's an airfield near you in Abishrool. He says, go down to George Fair. And he says, learn how to fly a small plane and it'll do whatever to fear.
And did it.
Yeah.
That's mad, isn't it?
Well, mm-hmm. No, in a cardboard box with a jackdaw pulling on it wouldn't bother.
That's brilliant. I love that you did that, though. So, lads, looking back over your time together, what was the most memorable or standout moment for you, Tony?
Top of the Pops. Has to be, yeah.
Brilliant. And, Grandad, what about you then?
Playing with Jimmy Shand.
I knew you were going to say that.
Being mine, because I was a Jimmy Shand fan since I was 5 or 6.
Yeah, he's quite...
I actually meet him and play with him. I mean, there was nothing, you know. I won 3 All-Irelands. Playing accordion, we've travelled the world, we've done Top of the Pops, but nothing would compare meeting him and playing with him.
So, lads, when it all finishes up, what would you like to be remembered for, Tony?
Oh, just for our music, I suppose, what we did, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be very happy with that.
For sure, and you should be.
Ah, yeah.
And what about you, Grandad?
Yeah, very same, that you know, that people don't forget us for a while, and... you know, hopefully they'll still like her music in another 50 years' time.
Definitely. Well, when I was sitting down to prepare the questions for this, it was such an emotional, like, thing for me to do, to look back on your career and having been a part of some of that. Because if I had chosen any other career, I probably wouldn't have got to make the documentaries with you, or go to the recording studio, or even go to Australia, and then even for today then to be filming the podcast with you is just so, so special. And to have 2 superstars on my podcast, I'm honestly so chuffed. Like, you are absolutely incredible at what you do. I'm so proud of the 2 of you. I genuinely really am. And I'm so proud that I can be a part of this with you and that you're here on my podcast. I'm honestly the luckiest person ever. I can't thank you enough. But genuinely, thank you so much for being on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
No bother. Anytime. You're just very, very welcome.
You're very welcome.